Steve Rosenberg.
Stephen Rosenberg is the BBC's Russia editor. He moved to Moscow in 1991 and since then has charted the transformation of the country from the conflict in Chechnya to the Beslan school siege, President Putin's rise to power, and the impact of the current war against Ukraine. As you'd expect, we're going to hear works by Russian composers such as Rachmaninoff, but also music from Steve's childhood and the many hours he spent watching TV. Steve loves to play the piano, posting his recordings on social media, anything from Postman Pat in the style of Tchaikovsky to a piece of music he wrote inspired by birds sitting on a telegraph wire. Your first choice, though, Steve, is Shostakovich, the first movement, I think, of the second piano concerto.
Yes, one of my favourite pieces of music. And I love the fact that Shostakovich composed this, I think, for his son, Maxim. And, you know, keeping music in the family is great. You know, I've got two kids and they both play piano and violin. And I love this concerto. Really a lovely piece of music.
What is it about this movement that you particularly love?
I think it's the fun, actually. I find it, you know, the first movement's fun, it's rousing, and there's a positivity there, which I like. And goodness me, we need positivity at the moment.
both smiling as the piano came in, weren't we?
Absolutely. I think Shostakovich was a big football fan. And, you know, when I hear that, I imagine some, you know, great football match flowing from end to end. That's great music.
Do you know his orchestration of Vincent Newman's T for Two?
No.
Oh, you must look it up. You'd like that. And it'll end up on your piano, I promise you. That was the first movement of Shostakovich's Piano Concerto No. 2 in F, performed by Dmitri Shostakovich Jr., the composer's grandson. Shostakovich wrote that piece as a 19th birthday present, as you said, for his son Maxim. And Maxim was actually the conductor of that recording, performed by the Montreal Symphony Orchestra, so a real family affair. Steve Rosenberg, tell us about what drew you to Russia in the first place. Why did you want to learn the language?
So when I was at school, our French teacher spoke a little bit of Russian and taught a few of us. But it was basically when Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in the mid-80s that I started to get interested in the country, because he was on our television screens non-stop, wasn't he? You know, this new kind of Soviet leader. And suddenly the Soviet Union, this very closed country, started to open up. And I was just fixated. I thought it was fascinating. So when I went to university, I thought I'd like to learn Russian properly.
And did you have any Russian relations in your family?
Well, my great-grandparents had been born in the Russian Empire. They'd left at the end of the 19th century. In fact, bizarrely, one of my great-grandfathers was born in a tiny little shtetl called Shklov in modern-day Belarus, where Alexander Lukashenko, the controversial leader of Belarus, comes from. But I didn't know about my ancestors when I decided to study Russian. And it was a 5-year course, but I knew that when I finished that, I wanted to use my Russian. But I also knew I wanted to work in broadcasting because, you know, as a kid, I'd watched a lot of television. And I mean a lot of television. I used to come back from school for lunch and watch the children's programmes on ITV and then come back in the afternoon and watch BBC children's programmes. And the music I was exposed to as a kid wasn't really Beethoven and Mozart and Shostakovich. It was the theme tunes.
What were you doing when you first got to Moscow in 91?
I was teaching English at the Moscow Machine Tool Construction Institute. I arrived a week after the communist coup. And just a few months later, the Soviet Union fell apart. A complete surprise to everyone. And then the crazy 1990s, where the country tried to move down a path of democracy. It was a very difficult decade, a bloody decade as well, with, you know, the Chechen War. And millions of people, millions of Russians fell into poverty. And yet there was hope. There was hope that this huge country would somehow get through all of this, right? And become a more democratic place and become a friend of the West.
How did you get into journalism then?
As a kid, I'd written hundreds of letters to the BBC. I mean, literally, I used to write to all kinds of departments, news and everything. And there were some incredible people who invited me up. And I got some work experience in school holidays. And when I went to Moscow, when the Soviet Union collapsed, international news organisations needed extra staff. So I got a job with American television, with CBS News, just answering the telephone, basically. And every night I had to watch the Soviet TV news, Vremya, and use this big old cranky telex machine to telex back the contents of this programme to New York. And gradually I worked my way up to producer.
Let's hear some of the music that you heard from those many hours watching television.
Yes, I mean, I miss the old days of ITV regional companies, right? Because in the old days, ITV companies had their own idents. And because I was born in North London, I used to love getting up early and watching the start-up of Thames Television, which always began with this piece, Perpetuum Mobile, by Michael Roberts.
Thank you.
I can remember the voice that came across. This is Thames Television broadcasting on the transmitters of the Independent Broadcasting Authority. And then that was followed by the amazing Salute to Thames anthem by Johnny Hawksworth. After that, they had two pieces. Great music. I love it.
This really conjures up for me this slightly obsessive little boy turning on the television to start his day and the world gets going. And actually, you know, it's of a certain kind of music, that, but it's very well written.
Absolutely. Slightly obsessive. That's probably even more than slightly obsessive. But I loved it.
Well, that was Michael Roberts' Perpetuum Mobile, otherwise known as the Thames TV ident or the Steve Rosenberg Morning Alarm. Tell me, where did music begin to get under your fingers, as it were? How did you come to start wanting to play music and doing it?
We had a grand piano at home and my mum played. And I made myself this pretend piano with a cardboard box, and I used to sit there, and my mum noticed that I was pretending to play at this cardboard box, so she thought, okay, well, let's get him some lessons. And there was a very nice lady at school who gave private lessons, and I did the grades, but I found myself trying to, you know, play
a lot, improvise
and play a lot of these TV themes as well, just try and have some fun at the piano.
So you had a good ear?
I think I had a good ear, yes. Yeah.
That can sometimes be a handbrake on reading at sight, can't it? Because you get so much fun from simply playing by ear that you can hardly be bothered as a child to start learning to read the dots.
You're absolutely right, and my sight reading is not good at all. That's probably a result of that.
When you left, Steve, the UK to go and live in Russia, it must have been very hard leaving family behind. Exciting, but also rather nerve-making.
I think it was hard for my parents. Right? I've got a brother and he was always interested in America. So he went off to live in America and I went off to live in Russia. So my poor mum and dad didn't really know what was happening. They were just left with a dog at home. I found it exciting, you know. I didn't expect that I'd still be there all these years later. And I find that Russia is like a huge Tolstoy novel. Right? You keep turning the pages and you want to see how it's going to finish. There are fun parts, there are tragic parts, there are horrific parts, there are chapters we just want to put the book down. But I still find it fascinating after all these years.
A Dvorak's Slavonic Dance next.
Yes, my mum didn't play a lot, but the one thing she did do was play duets with me. And this is a duet that we played a lot. That's why I remember it. And I played it with my daughter as well, when my daughter was learning to play the piano. So it's a piece of music that means a lot to me.
And of course, like a lot of Russian music, Dvorak is quite folk inflected, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one reason why we liked it so much.
Thank you. you play it at that speed?
Slower. And I tell you what, it took me quite a long time to learn it.
And were you playing the top part or the bottom part? I want to conjure this up.
Bottom part.
But you do get in both parts that slightly troika theme. Bum, 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 bum. Because he moves it from the right to the left,
yeah,
doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
Dvorak's Slavonic Dance in A-flat, Opus 46, number 6, performed by Katya and Marielle Lebec. Steve Rosenberg, you've seen Russia change immensely and had the chance to interview all kinds of people. And I wonder what the challenges are now for a British journalist working in Russia.
It's much harder now. I mean, when I think back to the 1990s, you know, we were best friends, Russia and the West. Now, if you switch on Russian state television, you get all this anti-Western rhetoric. There was recently a documentary series about how Britain was responsible for Hitler and the Nazis. You see how things have changed? And I find that incredibly disappointing.
Do they believe it when they say we sponsored Hitler, as it were? I mean, can they really believe things?
I don't know, to be honest. I think they say it so often now that perhaps they do believe it. What happens is they turn everything upside down and back to front. So you hear on the television that the West began the war in Ukraine and that Russia never starts a war, it only tries to stop wars. And I find that incredible because go back 10 years, and the one thing that Russians always said to me was, "Lish by ne bylo vojny," anything but war, we don't want war. And yet now, so many people say, oh, well, if the Kremlin has started this, there must be a reason for it, let's go to the end and try and win it. So everything is turned backwards. And that's quite hard to listen to from morning till night.
So it's brainwash and whitewash.
Yes. Russia today is a mixture of George Orwell's 1984 and Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass.
This must make you very sad because, perhaps like me, you obviously love Russia, its people, its culture.
Yes, it is. I mean, Russia's reputation around the world now is very low. But I fell in love with Russia. I fell in love with the people. They inspired me. The sacrifice that they made in the Second World War. Right? 27 million Soviet citizens were killed. And yet one year ago, you know, this giant black cloud came over this country, which I love. And suddenly it wasn't the Russia that I knew. It's a different Russia. And I find that very disturbing, fascinating. I'm trying to work out for myself what has happened. Why is it the country of Tchaikovsky, of Tolstoy, of Chekhov, of amazing people who I've met over 30 years, why it has taken such a dark path?
When I talked to people and said I was meeting you for Private Passions, they all asked the same question. How is he able to move around like he does? How much freedom does he have?
There's no one looking over my shoulder when I'm writing a piece. You know, we're free to write and say what we want.
I mean, if you were Russian, you wouldn't be able to say it's a war, would you?
Yeah, it's one thing being a foreign journalist, you know, with a British passport. It's another thing being a Russian journalist who's critical of the authorities. That takes a lot of courage. And what we've seen in the last year, we've seen the authorities suppress, close down the last vestiges, really, of independent media.
You mentioned earlier the Belarus president, Alexander Lukashenko, who proudly calls himself the last dictator in Europe. What was that encounter like?
That was one of the most bizarre interviews I've ever done. He's a very tall, imposing person. Sometimes it was like there was a little child in front of me, sometimes a bully. It was a weird experience. I had to sit there and be accused of all kinds of crimes. He said the West was doing this and that, and whatever. It was a difficult experience, but one that I won't forget.
You've managed to combine your musical interests with your political ones, because didn't you play the piano for Gorbachev?
Yeah, that was something I won't forget. We'd been recording an interview with Gorbachev, but after the interview, see, there was a piano in the corner of his office, and he said, "Does anyone play the piano?" And I put my hand up and said, "Yes, I play." And he said, "Well, sit down and play." So,
what did you play?
That was the question. What do you play when formerly one of the most powerful men in the world says, "Play my piano"? So I played some famous Russian tunes. I played "Midnight in Moscow," "Moscow Nights." I played a piece called "The Misty Morning," and I played a piece called "Dark as the Night."
Did he join in at all?
And he started singing. I was playing and he was singing. It was so touching. And then he said about his late wife, Raisa. He said, "Raisa loved it when I sang." And in those few musical minutes, I learnt more about Mikhail Gorbachev than in any of the big interviews that I'd done with him.
Темная ночь, только пули свистят по степи, только ветер гудит в провода, тускло звезды мерцают. В темную ночь ты, любимая, знаю, не спишь, и у детской кроватки тайком ты слезу утираешь. Как я люблю глубину твоих ласковых глаз, как я хочу к ним прижаться теперь губами. Темная ночь разделяет, любимая, нас, и тревожная черная степь пролегла между нами. Верю в тебя, в дорогую подругу мою, эта вера от пули меня темной ночью хранила. Радостно мне, я спокоен в смертельном бою, знаю, встретишь с любовью меня, чтоб со мной не случилось. Смерть не страшна, с ней встречались не раз мы в степи. Вот и теперь надо мною она кружится. Ты меня ждешь, и у детской кроватки не спишь, и поэтому знаю, со мной ничего не случится. Кроватки не спишь, и поэтому знаю, со мной ничего не случится.
Dark is the Night by Nikita Boguslavsky, a song from the Russian wartime film Two Fighters, performed on that vintage recording by the Russian actor and singer Mark Burness. You must have felt very sad when Gorbachev died last August.
It was very sad. We went to see Gorbachev's body. We went to the cemetery. And as the coffin was lowered into the grave, it was a very sad moment. It really felt as if this remarkable chapter of Russian history, when the country tried to become a normal democratic country with freedom of speech and freedom of movement, it felt as if Gorbachev's death marked the end of that chapter. Now, I'm generally an optimist, and if you step back and you take an overview of Russian history, the country for centuries has looked east and it's looked west and then it's looked east and looked west. It's like a metronome. Sometimes Russia feels it's part of the West, it wants to be open, it wants to be more democratic, and sometimes it looks the other way, like the double-headed eagle, its emblem. So perhaps the country will turn again, but at the moment it's looking away from the West, away from Europe.
Did Putin attend the funeral?
No, he didn't.
You've seen his rise. When he first took power, a lot of people, in fact, Bill Browder said that on this programme, almost welcomed somebody who might have an ability to sort out the mess, because there was a mess, wasn't there?
Absolutely. After the chaos of the 1990s, people wanted a bit of pariadok, order. And actually, if you look at his first term in office, order was restored to a large extent. And there were people suggesting that, well, order's one thing, but, you know, when independent media is being closed down and when oligarchs are being put in jail, where does this end? But he was very popular.
Did you ever manage to get close to him?
I've never managed to interview Putin. I've asked him questions at press conferences. And after the Salisbury poisoning in 2018, we managed to doorstep him. We just happened to be in the right place at the right time, in a greenhouse of all places in southern Russia, in Krasnodar. He was on the campaign trail. And we sort of popped out and asked him, was Russia behind the poisonings? And he was taken back and said something like, this isn't the moment to ask. You get to the bottom of things in your country and then we'll talk. Well, we hadn't spoken about it.
The newspaper seller Valentina, tell us about her.
Oh, Valentina. I miss her because she's moved away. But we became friends. I used to buy my newspapers every morning from her kiosk. And she had incredible stories to tell me about her life, which kind of reflects the Russian soul. And Russian suffering as well. I mean, her husband was a drunkard who used to beat her and throw knives at her. Her father was a drunkard who used to beat her mother. But throughout all of this, she had such a big smile on her face. She was so warm-hearted. She used to give me presents. She made me a huge, giant origami swan. She gave me a massive jar of honey from her dacha. And when the world was turned upside down by COVID and then by the start of the war, I used to run to Valentina's kiosk. It was like a little island of sanity. And she was a constant reminder to me of why I'd fallen in love with Russia.
Very nice to hear a piece now by Miroslav Skorich, who is a Ukrainian composer.
Yes, I've been playing quite a few Ukrainian songs on the piano the last year. And I discovered Miroslav Skorich, a great composer. He was born in Lviv, but his family was sent to Siberia during Stalin's terror. He composed some wonderful pieces. One of my favourites is Melodia, which has almost become a kind of a national hymn for Ukraine.
Melody by the Ukrainian composer Miroslav Skorik, performed there by the Odessa Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Hobart Earl. Music is probably quite a release for you, isn't it? Do you use it as something to get away from the world you've been describing?
Yes, it is a release, very much. When the world is going crazy around you, there's nothing better than to come home, close the door, rush to the piano and just try to escape into this sort of musical world, because the situation there is so intense and the pressures are so intense as well. So music does help.
Just give me an example of the kind of mashup, if you like, that you like to perpetrate on Land of Hope and Glory and other unwilling victims.
Oh, I've done all kinds. I've taken the Teletubbies theme and I've turned it into a tango. Postman Pat in the style of the Russian classics. 40 Towers theme tune 2.
And Good Life in the style of Rimsky-Korsakov.
Yeah, someone challenged me to do that on Twitter. And then someone sent me a photograph of birds on a telephone wires, which looked like musical notation.
Yeah.
So I tried to turn that into music as well. So
particularly starlings, they're very good at doing that.
Oh, right.
I saw them in Colombia and they almost were describing the opening of a symphony.
I thought you said Stalins there. That would have been very Soviet.
Let's talk a little bit about where your humour and music might come from. Of course, there's one person that springs to mind, isn't there?
Victor Borge.
Yeah.
When I was little, he used to pop up on Royal Command performances and things like that. And I just think he's so funny. He brought a lot of humour to music. He made it fun. And I think it's important to have fun with music.
Well, we've dug around and we've got a clip for you from his Mozart opera, recorded live at the Plymouth Theatre, Boston, in 1953.
Now is the time for the chorus. And the light is dimmed, so you can hardly see these people when they arrive, and that's why they're dressed in a kind of cheap underwear. Because there is no reason to spend a lot of money for costumes when you can't see them. Right? And that's the way the management of this theatre feels about it, and that's the way it's going to be. Here they come. Bread and butter. Now they're all in and they fool around in the dark for a little while. This is a mixed chorus. Bread and butter. Now they're out, they get their money and go home. Next, a baritone comes in and sings, Toreador, Toreador. But he finds out that he's in the wrong opera.
Eurovision, that's another great passion of yours, isn't it?
Yeah, Eurovision Song Contest was one of the few programmes I was allowed to stay up late to watch as a kid. And I was hooked from an early age. I think I was 6. And it was the crackly phone lines during the voting, which I thought were amazing. And all these different languages that people were speaking and singing in. And I started collecting Eurovision songs like some people collect coins or stamps.
You've been able to play every winning song since 1956, I'm reliably informed.
Yes, it's a sad truth that I can play every single winning Eurovision Song Contest song. I can't sit down and play Beethoven or Chopin, right, from memory, but I can play ABBA and Johnny Logan. And
it's clearly why you still possess some sanity, then.
Thank you. Yes, a little bit, but I love it. And actually, it's got me into some very interesting situations. I remember in the mid-90s, taking a tour of Russian television. And I wandered into a studio where they were rehearsing for that evening's Song for Europe competition, the Russian Heat, to choose the Russian song. And I got chatting to the director and told him I was interested in Eurovision. He said, oh, well, come back this evening. You can co-present programme. So I found myself co-presenting Russia's Song for Europe competition 1996. Crazy. That would never happen now.
Well, for your next choice, you've pushed aside ABBA, Sam Ryder, and you've chosen instead Charpentier.
Of course, because it's the Eurovision anthem. I mean, as soon as I hear this piece of music, I think of the Eurovision Song Contest, a contest which was created to bring peace to the world, to bring people together after the horrors of the Second World War. So it means a lot to me.
Thank you.
I wonder what Marc-Antoine Charpentier would have thought about his piece of music being used as the Eurovision anthem. Perhaps he'd have wanted to enter.
Well, he'd have enjoyed the royalties. We heard the Te Deum for solo, esquire and orchestra by Marc-Antoine Charpentier, performed by Les Arts Florissants, directed by William Christie. Steve Rosenberg, you've lived and worked in Russia for almost your adult life. Is it now really home?
It's home at the moment, but what happens in the future, I don't know. You know, I find it hard to think more than a week in advance now. It's very difficult to plan anything.
I wonder to what extent the war in Ukraine has affected Russian music and Russian culture. I mean, for example, conductors like Valery Gergiev are seen as close to Putin, while soprano Anna Netrebko seems to have been caught up in the crossfire. Has it had, the war, an impact on music and culture?
I think it has. I mean, inevitably. You know, Putin has said Russians need to decide who are the patriots and who are the traitors.
And there's not much in between, is there?
No. Russia is not a country of in-between. Russia is a country of extremes. You're either a patriot or a traitor. And one of the most famous pop stars, Alla Pugacheva, came out with an anti-war position. And basically, she's been hounded out of the country. And now the state media says awful things about her. And she was almost a goddess. On state TV, they show violinists, pianists who are considered to be patriots, people who go down to the front line and play music to the Russian troops. These are the people considered patriots. And I've heard stories from Russian music schools where Ukrainian songs, Ukrainian music has been banned. So naturally, what is happening on the battlefield has a knock-on effect on culture too.
It almost sounds worse than during the Cold War, when a non-political form of exchange between the two blocs in the form of culture and sport did exist and was considered important and a way of communicating. Even that seems to be at risk at the moment.
I think it's far worse than during the Cold War. I mean, in the Cold War, there were kind of rules worked out between the two blocs. And the Bolshoi Ballet came over, didn't it? And the Red Army Choir.
Some of them didn't go back, which meant it was rather difficult to get to the next tour. Yeah.
True. But we're in a very dangerous place at the moment.
Well, we're going to end on the second movement from Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2 in C minor. And I think you're revealing now, in addition to being an obsessive, that you're also quite clearly a romantic, Steve Rosenberg. I don't know if your wife would agree, but that's how it comes.
You'll have to ask her about that. Yes, I suppose I am, really. I'm an optimist and a romantic. This is a piece of music that I adore and the piece of music I listen to most, I think. Thank you. I feel quite emotional having listened to that. What is it about music, Michael, that really touches you and gets into you? And I don't know, I feel that the last year has been such a hellish year for Ukraine, of course, for Russia. It's been a tough year for us working there and seeing where Russia's heading. I don't know, just listening to that, it really brings home...
The pathos and the yearning.
And the tragedy that this country, which has produced such beauty... I really, really hope, and I don't know how this is going to happen, because I say we're in a very, very dark place at the moment, but I really hope that what is beautiful about Russia once again comes to dominate and to decide the future of this country, because at the moment... It's the horror, the dark sides of this country, which are deciding what's happening.
Well, Steve Rosenberg, thank you very much for bringing the music to us today. That was the second movement from Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2 in C minor, played by Boris Gilberg and the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, conducted by Carlos Miguel Prieto. Steve Rosenberg, thank you.
Thank you. You'll find details of all of Steve Rosenberg's music choices listed on the BBC Radio 3 website. And Michael's guest at the same time next week is Libby Jackson, the head of space exploration at the UK Space Agency. Private Passions is presented by Michael Barclay, and today's programme was produced by Claire Walker.
I am Oliver Arnalds, and I'm an Icelandic composer and pianist. Over the next 12 weeks, I'll be back to take you on more musical journeys to find ultimate calm. With guests including musicians Alice Sarah Ott and Arlo Parks. Ultimate Calm with me, Oliver Arnalds. The second series launches tomorrow night at 9 on Radio 3, with new episodes available every week on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio, on BBC Sounds, and on most smart speakers. A very good afternoon from me, John Shea, and if you're celebrating today, a very happy Easter to you. Our lunchtime concert is in a couple of minutes, but first at 1 o'clock, here's the latest BBC news. Armed police have kept Jewish and Muslim worshippers apart at one of Jerusalem's holiest sites, known by Jews as Temple Mount, on a rare convergence of religious holidays. The site is known as Al-Aqsa Mosque in Islam, and hundreds of Muslim worshippers have barricaded themselves in there. Israeli police stopped others from entering the compound and forced them to pray outside the old city gates. Earlier, Israel's planes hit targets in Syria after rockets were fired from there towards the occupied Golan Heights. The funerals of two British Israeli sisters who were shot dead in a suspected Palestinian attack in the West Bank on Friday will take place this afternoon. Rina and Maya Dee, who were 15 and 20 years old, died when their car was shot at in the Jordan Valley as they drove to the coast for a holiday. Their mother remains in a critical condition in hospital in Jerusalem. The National Medical Director of NHS England, Professor Sir Stephen Powis, has warned that this week's four-day strike by junior doctors could be the most disruptive one in the history of the service. The walkout in England over pay is due to begin on Tuesday, straight after the Easter bank holiday weekend. The British Medical Association, which represents doctors, says ministers have yet to make a serious offer. The Conservative Party has rejected a suggestion from its leader in Scotland that voters should tactically back Labour to oust the SNP. Douglas Ross told the Sunday Telegraph it would be doing what's best for the country to prevent another independence referendum. A Conservative spokesperson said Mr. Ross's view was emphatically not that of the party. The mother of the murdered 9-year-old Olivia Pratt Corbell has joined calls for a change in the law to force criminals to attend their sentencing. Last week, the man who shot her daughter in Liverpool sat in his cell while his sentence was read. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has used his Easter sermons to reflect on conflicts around the world. He told worshippers at Canterbury Cathedral that cruel and oppressive leaders would eventually face divine justice. Pope Francis has presided over Easter Mass at the Vatican, just over a week after he left hospital following treatment for bronchitis.
crowds of Catholic worshippers gathered in St Peter's Square. And the weather. This afternoon, western areas will become cloudy and windy, with rain spreading across Northern Ireland and more widely in the far western areas of England, Wales and Scotland by the evening. Top temperatures